Lecture 31. Wolf. To the Lighthouse, Part 2.
Virginia Woolf rivals Marcel Proust as our premier writer, it seems to me, about love, death, and memory. I've said, and because I believe, that Mrs. Ramsay is one of literature's greatest creations. And for that reason, it's all the more shocking, seems all the more brutal to see what her fate is. She is simply felled in this novel, not as a beast on a bed, which was the fate of the grandmother in Proust, but a death that is depicted essentially as an aside in brackets, not even narrated. It's awful. I spent some time in the last lecture on To the Lighthouse talking about the charming but inevitable gap in miscommunication between people who live together, husband and wife. And it's easy to imagine the impossibility of two subjectivities ever coming together perfectly as the kind of fate of marriage or the fate of human relationships. But of course, if you think about it, the true fate of human relationships, the most awful thing that happens to human relationships, is death. Death is what can dismantle, what will dismantle the human family. So this book has a kind of gravity in that regard, that it's about what happens to loving people when time, of course, exerts its terrible power. You may remember in Proust, the grandmother must essentially be recaptured, re-acknowledged, re-felt by the boy long after she's died in order for him to fully understand and fully feel the gravity and weight and horror of her loss. And in somewhat of that spirit, I'd like to return to Mrs. Ramsay and take a closer look at what it is that is so wonderful and that is going to die. Because in Mrs. Ramsay, I think Woolf gives us her most profound depiction of human reaches, of what sort of extension, what kind of dimensionality a self might have. So I was rather brief in my last lecture about her. There's more to her. We see her in this book as a very sensitive, exquisitely sensitive mother, attuned to the needs and wants, the unexpressed, unstated wants of her children, their natures, also the rather complex wants of her demanding husband, the needs and whims of the guests who come to her house. She is a well-endowed woman, and yet she can surprise us. And I want to read a passage that's one of the most famous passages in Woolf about Mrs. Ramsay's musings after she has put her son James to bed, and she is gathering the pictures that he's been cutting out, but she's alone now, and Woolf writes it like this: "For now she need not think about anybody. She could be herself, by herself. And that was what now she often felt the need of, to think, well, not even to think, to be silent, to be alone. All the being and the doing, expansive, glittering, vocal, evaporated. And one shrunk with a sense of solemnity to being oneself, a wedge-shaped core of darkness." It's a very striking phrase, a wedge-shaped core of darkness. And I'll talk more about it. "Something invisible to others." And the woman is continuing to knit. And once again, had you been there watching this scene, been the fly on the wall, all you'd seen is a woman knitting. You couldn't have known what she's thinking about. But in this case, what she is thinking about is so germane because she is thinking about where she really is. And this wedge-shaped core of darkness is nothing less than something that is vehicular. It's something that is a journey, a voyage. And so that's how Woolf continues to write it. "It was thus that she felt herself, and this self, having shed its attachments, was free for the strangest adventures. When life sank down for a moment, the range of experience seemed limitless." It's interesting. We think of it when life sinks down, when the people that we know leave the room and we sit on a sofa by ourselves. We rarely think of this as a moment of extraordinary exploration and expansion, but that's what it is. And she feels that everyone she knows has these same resources and probably secretly, unknowably, is taking the same kinds of trips. She finally says, "Beneath, it is all dark." And she means beneath the surface, beneath the flesh, beneath what we can see about people. Inside, Beneath it is all dark. It is all spreading. It is unfathomably deep. But now and again, we rise to the surface. And that is what you see us by. And that, she says, is what you see us by. To me, it's an astonishing passage. It's an extraordinarily rich exploratory passage about the whereabouts of self, about the mobility of self, that what you see us by, which is, in other words, what you see me when you look at me, what I see you as when I look at you, what you see when you look in the mirror, what you see when you look at others, all of that's the tip of the iceberg, as the old cliche has it. Most is underneath. But even that won't begin to take the measure of what Wolf is saying, because it's not just underneath, it's on the move. These strange adventures are taking place. We are mobile, untrackable creatures, fluid creatures. It's not just that there is more to us on the inside, but what is on the inside is also elsewhere and other. This, of course, radically challenges our sense of a bounded form of identity. This is me. You can see my shape, my contours. No, Wolf would say. All we can see is the sort of tip of it. All we can see is the illusory shell of things, of people. And that our apparently cogent and identifiable self is something of an illusion. It's an illusion for other people's benefit. Therefore, any kind of realistic art form, like a traditional novel that just describes, and some of them describe in great detail, what a person looks like, how tall they are, what their hair looks like, what their features look like, what the implicit response here in Wolf is that, well, that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that, but it just doesn't get what matters. Because it can't possibly track that voyage that's taking place on the inside, which is the true promiscuity, the true dimensionality, the true mobility of every human being. The self in Wolf goes out for adventures. It goes out, as we might say today, on wildings, outings. In the 16th century, the French philosopher Montaigne used the wonderful word ondoyant, ondoyant, which means wave-like, to try to describe the human psyche, that it's wave-like. And people have, I think persuasively, connected Montaigne's view of the human psyche to Shakespeare's, and in particular Hamlet. Hamlet's personality is thought of also as ondoyant. What does all of that mean? Well, it means that we are other unto ourselves even, that we move and shift and reform. How many times have people told you, you're not yourself today? And what do you think they mean by that? You're not yourself today. If you're not yourself today, who are you when they tell you that? And for the most part, I think what we come up with is that they themselves have a fixed, bounded sense of who we are, but that for whatever reason, for mood or whatever else, we are acting out a different self today, one that they know nothing about, one that seems out of character, as far as they're concerned. You're not yourself today. I think that Wolf is pointing at something quite fascinating. How much bookkeeping, how many sort of strings do you have to tie on your fingers to maintain a stable, recognizable self? It's as if when we get out of bed, we recompose the self that everybody knows, and we trot that self off to work or whatever, or to the breakfast table. But I think what Wolf is saying is that actually things are far more anarchic than that. That we have far more possibilities in it, in ourselves. Could self itself be a kind of restrictive frame, a prison even? I want you to reflect on that. Could self be a prison? I think at times it is. I think that's true for many people's lives. And I'm going to go further and probably make a fool of myself by saying, you might say that people do drugs and change mates and do all kinds of things in their lives in order to recreate their self, in order to somehow find another self, because they are so dreadfully fatigued or hurt or whatever by the self that they've got, that self really could be something asphyxiating and suffocating. It seems to me Wolf's passage about that inward core of darkness points to all of these matters. And one of the most surprising moments where we see the fuller extensions of this, it seems to me, is where Wolf tries to depict in this novel a scene of pleasure. Now, Virginia Woolf is rather well known for being extremely sort of scrupulous about depicting scenes of pleasure. In fact, perhaps even a little bit hemmed in And friends of hers, like Lytton Strachey, said, you know, where's the copulation in your books? I mean, if you're looking for sex in novels, you don't read Virginia Woolf. Although Woolf's biographers read her work with great prurience, it seems to me, to find out about her own possible lesbian interest. But there is a moment in To the Lighthouse, which is really one of the most sexually exquisite things that I know in literature. And it's where the self seems to flow out, not really as a hemorrhage, but as, again, an adventure. Mrs. Ramsay awakens at night, and the steady, pitiless, remorseless light of the lighthouse bends across the floor in their summer house, and it bends across the bed as if it were stroking her. And Woolf writes of it as silvery fingers stroking a sealed vessel in her brain, making it burst with pleasure. And the sea is described as rolling in waves of pure lemon that curve and swell and break on the beach. This is a version of ecstasy, of bursting these vessels. How can you not think that it's also a description of orgasm? It's a description of the entire organism being flooded with pleasure. This is how sexuality gets written in Woolf. Ecstasy, as you doubtless know, etymologically means ecstasis, to be moved from the place that you are. And I think what Woolf is getting at, and it's surprising, it seems to me, is that our moments of greatest pleasure are strangely impersonal and anonymous. They may be just the moments when we escape the confines of self and let go of our contours and encounter and experience otherness. So all of that, I think, is what's in play with that passage about the core of darkness, the inward core of darkness. And all of that tells us, again, something about the gravity and tragedy of the loss that occurs when this woman dies or is felled by Virginia Woolf. The death of Mrs. Ramsay stuns us, partly because it comes slightly more than halfway into the novel, which again seems to break all the rules of fiction. And many readers are shocked by this. And moreover, it comes in brackets. As I said, it's not even a beast on a bed. It's almost like an aside. We read about Mr. Ramsay in brackets, bracketed in the text, stumbling along a passage on a dark morning, and he reaches out his arms. And then Woolf actually writes, but Mrs. Ramsay, having died rather suddenly the night before, his arms remained empty. Well, that sets the stage for the great questions of this novel that I want to think about as we work through the end of this lecture. What survives? What's left when someone of this kind of beauty and vitality dies? Because those are life's and biology's laws. The way the book is structured is that the middle section of it is about the reign of night. In this sequence, the novel seeks ways to depict chaos. There's a marvelous line, which many people know from Othello, when Othello remarks that if he no longer loves Desdemona, if that should ever happen, chaos is come again. And I think that's what happens in this text. But it doesn't just come because Mrs. Ramsay dies. It's as if that wedge-shaped core of darkness, which was her expression for the freedom and mobility of the human mind as the self exits the contours that we know ourselves by, and goes on these strange adventures, as if that darkness moved from being a term for human subjectivity and becomes a term for the terrible darkness of the world and of life itself. Earlier, I called Mrs. Ramsay a connoisseur of chaos, who knows that life is brutal, who knows that life will pounce on you if you give it a chance, who knows that life will erase you, who knows that her children themselves will never be as happy later as they seem to be now. And so that darkness spreads over the novel. It's like night enters the novel. And what it is doing in this text is that it is also operating, it seems to me, as a kind of code language for an event we know all too well, which is World War I. That what Woolf is talking about is night that spreads over Europe, night that spreads over civilization. And she has found a way to write this as the story of a particular family where the loving mother dies, and so too will some of the children. And so we understand that chaos means not just the death that takes a single endowed, beautiful person, but that it takes many people. That it dismantles the summer house itself, and it dismantles the people who've lived in it. And we remember again the scene the exquisite, beautiful, simple, domestic scene of the dinner party, of people sitting around a table in a house on an island surrounded by the sea, by the elements. And as I have said, we have to realize how disproportionate those forces are. The elements have to win. The fragility of that human family, that human construct, sharing this timeless ritual of food and wine and talk and love. Wolfe has actually written that passage about looking out the window when they're seated together, quote, where things wavered and vanished waterily. She invents that adverb, waterily. And it's as if the water and the elements now take over, and the wind itself, and the night. Wolfe calls that the little airs. The little airs. That's her term for the damage and the deterioration that is meted out to the summer house. And we watch these little heirs, and we watch them attack the house, which, of course, if you know anything about summer houses that are left unattended for years on end, or any house, we watch the deterioration and the decay and the dismantling of the house. They invade the cottage, these little heirs. The wallpaper goes. Then Wolfe writes, and it's really rather frightening, they make their way towards the bedroom. It almost is the language of rapists. They make their way to the bedroom. They're going to dismantle the bedroom too. The place where husband and wife have their nightlife together. The place where the lighthouse itself caresses the body of Mrs. Ramsay. These are the forces of destruction and entropy that one cannot say no to. And so we have the deaths of many Ramsays, not only Mrs. Ramsay, but we read again in brackets that Prue Ramsay married, with her father escorting her down the aisle, and then within one or two lines that she died in childbirth. And we read in brackets as well that a shell exploded and some 20 or 30 soldiers are blown up in France. And the next sentence is, Andrew Ramsay is one of them, one of the children. These are the brutal forces of nature that nothing can stop. This is the reign of night. This is the horrendous transformation of that inward core of darkness. It's not inward anymore at all. It's outward. It's something like the tempest. It's something like the horrible forces of destruction that we see in Lear on a heath. In fact, Lear is not a bad analog to the lighthouse, because it too is about the huge forces of turmoil and war that will destroy the human family. There's a wonderful domesticity in Lear, and we watch it being wrecked. We watch discord in a family. There's no discord in this text, but it's the same pathos about the family being taken apart. So it is that the third phase of the novel depicts the return of those who have survived to the same summer house to see what is left. It's the great question. It's the great human question. What is left after our loved ones die, after some of them die? And this is where the role of Lily Briscoe becomes far more prominent. Lily is the kind of charming, but rather shy, spinster friend of the Ramsays, who is, in a sense, the figurative daughter of Mrs. Ramsay. And many readers and critics, I think, have taken the view that, in a sense, if Mrs. Ramsay represents Virginia Woolf's mother, to some extent, Lily is a self-portrait of Virginia Woolf. I'm not sure how much I buy that, but nonetheless, that's been said. But Lily comes to that house 10 years later and feels nothing. How can feeling be reborn? Time not only destroys people, but it erases what we felt for them. Time destroys us who live as well as those who die. The book has spent time talking about Lily's really quite beautiful, tender feelings for Mrs. Ramsay. One wonders whether Mrs. Ramsay herself fully understands it. And there's one passage that's frequently cited where Lily is sitting next to Mrs. Ramsay and she has her arms around Mrs. Ramsay's knees and she's sort of pressing her knees and she wonders whether Mrs. Ramsay can possibly feel what she is feeling. And what she imagines inside of Mrs. Ramsay's heart and mind as she's sitting there with her arms lovingly around this woman's knees are tables, tables that bear sacred inscriptions. And she asks herself, could you read these inscriptions? It's a very sweet, interesting image. Could you read these inscriptions that are located deep inside the inner sanctum of the person that you love? Are they readable? Are they knowable? But then we watch this evolve, this particular passage. That instead these sacred inscriptions become urns and they become waters that are poured from one to another. And then Lily seems to question, could you press into another's secret chambers? Now that's not a question of reading. Could you press, it's almost a sexual image, could you press into another's secret chambers? And then it goes further, how do you become the same as the person that you love? These are the great questions of human relationship. They're the great questions of marriage. I have said, this is our premier text about marriage, about what it means. Could you become the same as the one you love? And in that light, what we see that these inscriptions about reading become something far more somatic, it seems to me, something far more about human flesh and desire, that what we seek is not so much knowledge as unity, fusion with the other. It's a lovely account of the language of desire, of the need to become the one that you love. And that's what has to be reborn 10 years later. Lily, in some sense, has to resurrect those feelings of tenderness and desire that she felt for Mrs. Ramsay. Lily also remembers that Mrs. Ramsay's mantra about marry, marry, marry was in its own way rather quaint. I mean, Lily is a spinster. She doesn't have at all the same belief in marriage. And moreover, she can see now in hindsight that the great lady got it wrong at times. And in particular, I mentioned this young couple, the Raleys, Paul and Minta. You remember that Minta has lost her brooch on the sand, and it turns out that they will become married. It also turns out that their marriage will fail, and Wolfe will refer to it in some very striking passages about how the two of them were in love and then not in love. They still lived together, they still were friends, but that love had died. Lily knows this. We never know how she knows it, but she knows it, and she thinks to herself, boy, did Mrs. Ramsay get it wrong. And Wolfe actually suggests that, you know, one of the few benefits of people that you love dying is that when they're dead, you can finally gloat about how they got it wrong. It's not a very pretty perception, but it's an interesting perception. That they're not there anymore, you're no longer sort of afraid to ever say how fully you disagree with them. And so Lily is gloating. You were wrong, wrong, wrong. Take a look at the Raleys. They didn't last together. And then, in a kind of really marvelous passage, we have this, the words in love come to Lily's mind. And when those words come to her mind, there's a kind of explosion of a great pagan scene of fire and celebration on a beach, of roar and crackle, of a sea that has turned red and gold. And you realize this is the landscape of love. This is what Lily is being rocked by as she remembers Paul and Minta. And you actually get the sense that, well, it makes no difference that they're no longer in love, because nonetheless, love lives. Love comes in and startles and brutalizes this spinster woman who is an artist. And her reaction to it is, I think I will move a little bit the line and the color on my painting. It's the only way she knows how to respond. That's an interesting line about, I will change something in my painting. And I used to think, what a silly response that is. What an inadequate, incommensurate response that is to human love, which is the great drama that Lily has missed. Well, first, I'm wrong on so many fronts here. Lily hasn't missed it. She has, in fact, loved Mrs. Ramsay, and that love we're going to see is inseparable from her art. So the final part of the book, in some sense, is about resurrection. It's about what still can be brought back to life, not just what remains, but what can be brought back to life. And human feeling is going to come about as the fuel, the motor force for resurrection, for animating these survivors. And that's when we realize how much this title means, going to the lighthouse. As I said, that was the great question at the beginning of the book. Will we go or will we not go? To go or not to go? It's almost Shakespearean. And Mrs. Ramsay has said, yes, we will go if it's fine. And Mr. Ramsay says, no, it won't be fine. But now, in the third section of the book, plans are made for a real visit to the lighthouse. That Mr. Ramsay now, and it's never quite said as it, Wolfe doesn't write this as a tribute to Ramsay's dead wife, but the reader can't help feeling that, yes, this is the great project that is now going to be actualized and completed. They will go. He will take two of his now grown-up children to the lighthouse, and they will bring gifts. During the early part of the novel, we keep seeing Mrs. Ramsay knitting, and she's knitting socks for the son of the lighthouse keeper. These gifts will be brought to the lighthouse. The imagery is unmistakable. It picks up John Donne's famous lines that no man is an island, and you once again realize that's the way this novel is written. this family, human family, fragile family of people who love each other in a summer house on an island in the sea. And they're going to go into the watery element in order to reach the lighthouse, which itself is a kind of structure in the midst of the sea, an almost an emblem of human isolation. And they're going to bridge to it. They're going to make the trip to it. That's the title, To the Lighthouse. And he will take the children with him, the two of the surviving children. And there's nothing mushy and gooey about this. They remember what a tyrant he was. You remember the passage that I cited earlier about Mr. Ramsay storming his wife with his need for affection, and James there huddled between her knees, hating his father, wanting in fact to take a knife and pierce his father's breast. They will sit there in this boat with their father as they move towards the lighthouse, remembering what a bully he was, and at the same time wanting nothing more than to please this man who is their father, to do right by him, to receive his love and his benediction. So completing the narrative of the trip to the lighthouse, the literal trip to the lighthouse, is what I would call a figurative trip to the lighthouse. And not surprisingly, it comes to us as a work of art. Lily Briscoe will reprise the painting that she never finished, which was a painting of Mrs. Ramsay, and she will try to complete it. And we have to see these things as versions of each other. Lily completing the painting, Mr. Ramsay taking the children to the lighthouse. Both of these are, in some sense, grand tributes to Mrs. Ramsay. This second voyage, Lily's painting, I think is really nothing less than an effort to bring Mrs. Ramsay back to life. Whitman once, in his great elegy to Lincoln, talked about art as being retrievements out of the night. Whitman was thinking about the death of the president, of Lincoln being assassinated. But retrievements out of the night is a lovely image, it seems to me, of our tribute to the dead, our memory of the dead, our way of, in fact, making it possible, miraculously, that the dead are not dead through our memory, through our tribute. And so this painting is meant to do exactly that. How do you paint a picture of someone who's dead? How do you paint a picture of someone whom you loved? How do you paint a picture in such a way that your love for this dead person reappears, shows, is part of the picture? And in that light, the person is no longer dead. And isn't that what art is? One looks at a painting, a portrait of someone, and they're there. Their bones may be moldering in the earth, and yet they're there, living in the picture. But anyone who has ever tried to paint knows this is no simple matter. The way Wolfe expresses it, to exchange the fluidity of life for the concentration of painting. And Lily feels that her grand desire to be a painter is fraught with impossibility. It's a contest, she says, that you cannot win. You're fated to lose. Art can never match the kind of quicksilver nature of reality. It can't do it. It's not in the cards. And yet, it is a gallant challenge. It's a grand challenge. It's the one that you don't duck, that you try to meet. And so she does try to meet it. And Wolfe writes this as actually tunneling into the past, that the way she makes this painting is to sort of re-immerse herself in the actual substance of Mrs. Ramsay. It's very close to Proust here. Because the only way to capture Mrs. Ramsay on canvas is, in fact, to fully experience her death. You may remember I said Lily returns to this empty house and feels empty herself. The dead are dead. There's no feeling. And only when this feeling is rekindled, is reborn, can the painting take place. But, of course, it hurts when the feeling is reborn. And Lily is stunned and shocked. It's 10 years later. And she discovers to her surprise that these are tears, salty tears coming out of her eyes. She says to herself, is it possible that we can still be hurt? That we can be hurt 10 years later by the death of the people that we loved? And we feel like this is the very birth of Mrs. Ramsay again, the rebirth of her. It takes place through the tears of those who loved her. That this is hunger, tears. And I'm saying all of this partly because it's possible to read To the Lighthouse as a kind of work of art about art. Closes with Lily, who's making a painting. But the aesthetics are secondary to the human feelings. It's feeling that makes art possible. And so at the end of this book, Lily completes her painting just as Mr. Ramsay arrives at the lighthouse with the children. And as he gets off of that boat, he looks back, and Wolfe writes, with his long-sighted eyes, Perhaps he could see the dwindled leaf-like shape standing on end on a plate of gold quite clearly. What could he see? This is the thoughts of his children. What is he looking back for? And the island he looks back towards is the island where that house was, is, where his wife lived. And I think the plate of gold is just such a beautiful image because it has turned into something precious. And as he gets off the boat, Wolf writes, he sprang lightly like a young man. And it's a beautiful moment. It's like going back to the past, recapturing the past, recapturing his dead wife, recapturing human love. That's what Wolf has created in this book, that art is the outcome of love and desire, and it makes life. Thank you.